We'll come to order. First item on the agenda is Senate File 1462. This was a layover from last committee that we did not have time to cover. Senator Scogan.
Do you have smokeless gun?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. If you turn your attention to Senate File 1462, you'll see a bill there that deals with the deer season and restrictions. Last year, a restriction was put in on smokeless gunpowder. I come to you today with constituent requests that would like to use the smokeless gunpowder. And what we have found with the different guns that are now being used, some of them use the smokeless powder. They are becoming, these muzzle loaders are becoming more and more sophisticated. I know that we talk about putting scopes on them now and can really dial them in for some long-range hunting. And some of these guys have walked kind of away from being traditional muzzle loaders now and have kind of gone high-tech. And they would like that opportunity. And they find this letter C in the bill to be restrictive, and they would like that removed. I'm carrying it for the constituents. I have no one to testify in favor, and I'm not sure if Ed or Bob, did you want to speak?
Is this your constituent, Mark Anderson from Long Prairie?
That is actually Senator Ingebrigtsen's constituent, but I'm not quite sure how I ended up with it. I got a couple of phone calls, and then Mark sent me the letter. Is what happened. So.
Well, I have heard about this issue, too, in my district from constituents. And I did a little checking as well. Couldn't get much information on what the reason for the repeal was. Including DNR, but we couldn't seem to find any information on that. But Mr. Meyer, would you like to?
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. For the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. Just to your question, Mr. Chair, the language was included in the Game and Fish Bill last year. The House brought the language in kind of as a counter to putting scopes on muzzleloaders, which was the Senate position at the time. The traditional muzzleloader season was established for the flintlock, ball cap muzzleloaders before the inlines were invented. Since that time, technology has come a long way. Smokeless powder, the piece I just handed out that says, I swear, Mr. Game Warden, it is really a muzzle loader, is a rifle that's available right now, commercially produced, that will achieve the same ballistic characteristics as a .30-06 will or a 300 Winchester short mag, something of that nature, depending on the powders you're using. And I apologize for the copy, but you can see the velocity there using a 200-grain projectile at 300 yards is 2,050 feet per second, which is very fast. A 30-06 that I load my cartridges, I use about 48 grains of powder, and I get about 2,500 feet per second. And that's at 100 yards. You can see this rifle is 2,750, so it's actually going faster than what my 30-06 rifle will do. The concern is not one of a biological issue. It's a concern of technology creep into the hunting sports as well. It's more of a cultural issue, a user conflict issue. I spent about an hour on the phone last night with Mr. Anderson talking about his positions, what he's been doing. He's shooting, it's a Savage rifle. It's a muzzle loader 10, ML-10 model. It is able to shoot black powder alternatives, and also smokeless powder. It achieves similar velocities to smokeless powder, with the smokeless powder or black powder substitutes, Mr. Chair. It's one of a cultural issue that we see. If the smokeless powder ban were to take place or the prohibition be repealed, and then you put scopes on muzzle loaders in a year or this year even, there's really no reason to have that muzzle loader season. You will be allowing people to hunt with rifles that are ballistically efficient to the rifles that are used in the rifle season. And the technology, there's no difference. When the muzzle loader season was put into place for something that a person may have made or collected using a ball traditionally with powders that were historically made and allowing them to an extra opportunity to take deer with those types of weapons. So just as we talked about the Bear Baiter Buffet, they have crossbows in the House Game and Fish Bill, allowing people to use crossbows to hunt. It's one that is a social issue. People are on both sides of the issue, but it's something that you folks, as members of the legislature, need to decide. Where do you want what was once established as a traditional muzzleloader season to be? Do you want it to be expanding into all of these new technologies, or is it one that tradition and the culture should be preserved for people to enjoy as a traditional muzzleloader season?
Mr. Meyer, what is an inline muzzleloader as opposed to any other type of muzzleloader?
Inline technology refers to the way that the flash is used to ignite the powder. An inline muzzleloader will have a straight barrel and a breech plug typically that you screw in or is somehow inserted into the barrel. And the inline refers to the way the spark is transferred from the primer into the powder. So it's a straight line. Typically, these rifles use a 209 shotgun primer, which is the same primer you use in a 12-gauge shotgun shell. It's placed in the breech plug, and then when you pull the trigger, a firing pin hits the primer, igniting the powder in a straight line fashion. So if you looked at it this way, there's a hole through the barrel or through the back of the barrel where the primer sits on. The flash goes in a straight line into the powder charge versus a flash. The traditional muzzleloaders either use a flash or flintlock, or they'll have a percussion cap where it comes in. If this is the barrel, Mr. Chair, there'll be a hole on the side of the barrel where the flash pan would be here. The hammer would go down, the charge would go through the side, or a percussion cap where the hammer would hit it and that charge would go through the side.
Does the inline method increase the speed of the reload?
Mr. Chair, members, the reloading of a muzzle loader is still going to require putting a charge down the barrel, packing that charge, putting a patch down there, or a sabot, which would be a bullet with a plastic case on it, or in some cases they have bullets that already have the plastic attached to the bottom of it. And pushing that down to compact it on top of the charge. You need to have it tightly packed onto top of the charge to gain that, to capture that velocity, so when the powder is ignited, you capture the gases which pushes the bullet out of the barrel.
Mr. Chairman. So the smokeless gunpowder is an improvement in what way?
It's more volatile. I mean, it... Right? I mean, is that a fair statement?
The technology, it allows you to achieve faster velocities. The main difference, depending on the charge, is the velocities that you use or are able to use, types of powder, and the ability to not have to clean your rifle as much, and the cost, people will say. You'll see Mr. Anderson's letter talks about you can obtain similar velocities using Pyrodex or a Pyrodex alternative, but the amount of sulfur that would be contained in that powder is less, causing it to be less corrosive to your barrel. But you can see on this rifle here, the Bad Bull muzzle loader, it allows you to use other powders. The Savage Arms rifle, they recommend three different smokeless powders if you're going to use that, and they recommend you don't use any other ones. But this other rifle, the technology is coming out. There's about three that are out there right now. This one that I handed out is pretty expensive. I doubt if anybody's using that in Minnesota. The Savage is comparable to a regular muzzle loader. It is it's a hybrid, if you want to call it. It can use three different powders. Its cost, its cleaning, and the ability to obtain with certain cartridges and powders velocities that are similar to your centerfire cartridges.
The Chairman? Doesn't that reduction of corrosion make it a somewhat safety improvement? If you don't have to clean it as much, you're reducing corrosion.
Mr. Chair, members, it would be a convenience improvement, not as much of a safety improvement.
Well, why do you clean your gun in the first place?
Mr. Chair, hopefully to have it operate more efficiently.
And not blow up in your face.
That's a good thing. And to be efficient.
And then question that Mr. Anderson had is his letter about, or the statement, the advantage to having less smoke is that you can see the game and see how the game reacts to the shot. You can then tell if it has been hit. You can identify the direction in which the game runs, preventing a loss in harvesting your game. Isn't that a positive effect in kind of the whole ethics of hunting?
Mr. Chair, members, yes, it would be.
Senator Pearson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Scogin, this is a fascinating topic. I think maybe it would be kind of helpful if you could host an event for some of us in the legislature to get some examples and watch a presentation and uses of the different models out there sometime.
I would love to.
Maybe you and Senator Ingebrigtsen could find a place.
I'm not a muzzleloader, Senator Pearson, so I would have to sit in the audience with the rest of you.
That'd be good, too.
Well, that Viking Valley Hunt Club district is just gorgeous. It would be a gorgeous place to do a field trip.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm looking at this handout that will fit with your bill, but in reading the text under here, it's with MOA accuracy. Senator Anderson and I, MOA stands for the Mall of America. Now, could you, I have a hunch that that's not what that acronym means, but could you tell me what it is?
Mr. Chair, members, Senator Olson, that actually was my handout that I handed out. It's minute of angle accuracy. They're saying a 3-inch group at 300 yards. So if you brought that down to 100 yards, it'd probably be about a 1-inch or inch and a half grouping. So, you know, you're going to be inside the 10 ring all the time.
Mr. Chairman, I think we need to adopt over here a policy like Hennepin County did of charging a fine every time there's an acronym used without spelling out what it is. They had to throw a quarter into the fountain to go to a charity every time that it went. But thank you for that explanation. Minute of angle.
Got to write that down.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just probably a DNR question here, an observation. Now that if this were to go, and you're saying that the accuracy of the muzzleloader now is becoming comparable to that of a rifle, with the muzzleloading season being extended, that's a longer season, correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, it runs from the Saturday after Thanksgiving for 16 days. And the way the muzzleloader season is, either you buy the all-season license, which is a license for the archery season, the regular rifle season, and the muzzleloader season, or you either have to purchase a rifle license or a muzzleloader license. You are not able to buy a regular rifle license and then a muzzleloader license. You have to have one or the other at this point in time.
Just to follow up, my point is that we have a muzzleloading season for a reason, because it is fair chase. Is that kind of what it was about? My only concern is if these things start to getting more like a rifle, more accurate like a rifle, is the DNR then going to suggest that we cut down our season time? That's my only question.
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, as the technology does come into the hunting tradition, it's something that we need to work with the decision makers, as to what should happen. As these rifles become more advanced, does it make sense to have a separate season for them, or perhaps run the full firearm season over into the muzzleloader season? Those are social issues dealing with the traditions of hunting and hunting seasons that the department, in conjunction with you, the policymakers, need to have.
Well, the principle, in my view, of a muzzleloader season is that you have one shot. And you have to, you basically have one shot. If you take one shot, you're going to have to reload and all of that. By the time you reload, your second shot is more than likely wasted. So you really only have one shot. That's the point of a muzzleloader. We allow everything else. We allow the ladders. We allow the warm clothing. Do the glaze orange. So all of that is kind of, civilization creep, so to speak. So I mean, the I think we have, when we're talking about a traditional hunt, I think we have to look at what makes the muzzle loader truly traditional. And that, in my opinion, it's the fact that you can only take really one shot at your target. And I don't see how removing smokeless powder impacts that. Others might have a different point of view. In fact, it could improve safety and the ethical shot itself, making sure that's more accurate and effective. Senator Engelbert.
Yeah, just to follow up, I agree. I agree with this bill 100%. I just, that thought is out there that, that the season will be shortened if they get to be more like rifles. And you're right, one shot is definitely a challenge for the whitetail.
And Senator Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I have to apologize because I was late. So I'm probably going to ask something that's already been asked. So what I don't understand is why the DNR or whatever the law, the reason for the law being there in the first place. Yeah, why exactly. Were we concerned about smokeless gunpowder?
We talked about that a little bit. Really, the answer is vague. The closest we've gotten is that this was a Representative Hackbarth proposal in response to the Senate allowing scopes on muzzle loaders. So the idea was, if we're going to allow scopes, well, then we're going to have to, we can't have smokeless powder. And so we ended up taking out the allowing scopes, but we didn't remove the smokeless powder repeal either.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm a lot more concerned about remote control and electronics used in hunting than this sort of thing.
I mean, if you have less smoke, you're
good thing.
I think that's probably a good thing. Anyway, any more other comments from the
Mr. Chair, members, just on Senator Anderson's question, you know, the advent of the muzzle-loading rifle that can burn smokeless powder really is new on the hunting horizon. It's been out for 4 or 5 years. There's several that are out there, and the reason it was even discussed is that allowing the smokeless powder to be used gives you a charge that is ballistically efficient as a centerfire rifle. These rifles are allowed. Smokeless powder is allowed in a muzzleloader during the rifle season. It's just that when the traditional season was established, inlines weren't even invented. We had people using the musket rifle, the ball, the patch, and really the issues as you go back to smokeless powder, and then if the legislature does allow scopes on muzzle-loading rifles, then we will be looking at what this season should be. Should it be a muzzle-loading season? Should we expand the regular season? Should we shorten the season? We will go back with the stakeholders and try to come up with some recommendations on how that season should be managed.
Fair
enough.
That's what I'm wondering.
If there's no further discussion, Senate File 1462 will be laid over for consideration in the omnibus bill.
Sure. Thank you, committee. Thanks.
Senate File 1402, Senator Dill.
Roosevelt.
I don't know. Can we just put it, lay it over for your omnibus bill?
Well, Madam, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate File 1402 is a bill that has been in process for about 3 years. It just was introduced this session for the first time. In 2005, I had a series of meetings with about 30 groups that were invited. They didn't all attend, but we went over this idea of trying to do something to enhance the control of urban sprawl, preservation of farmland, forest land, wildlife habitat land, and open space land through a series of meetings and a series of bill drafts. We got through the sixth draft of the bill in the end of March 2005, and then everything was put aside because we're kind of late in the session. I picked it up again this session, and with some additional input from Ron Harnack, the Department of Agriculture, Senator Shottery, and others, we've prepared this seventh draft, which you see before you. Now, I'm calling this bill the Teddy Roosevelt Memorial Bill, President Teddy Roosevelt Memorial Bill, to preserve agricultural, forest, wildlife, and open space land. And just to kind of talk first of all why I'm doing that before we get into the bill, you've got a handout before you that has Teddy Roosevelt's picture on it and some of the things that he did. He was an amazing conservationist. He was born in 1858. At age 23, he was elected to the New York legislature. Then in 1887, he started the Boone and Crockett Club, which was designed to preserve open space and wildlife habitat and so forth. And one of the main things they accomplished was they saved Yellowstone National Park from being invaded with railroads and lumbermen and so forth. It was already a national park at the time, but they stopped further development within the park through efforts at the national level. Of course, in 1898, he was the leader of the Rough Riders who led the Rough Riders up San Juan Hill in Cuba and helped win the Spanish-American War. That same year, he was elected governor of New York. And 2 years later, in 1901, he was elected vice president of the United States, a position he held for approximately 6 months before President McKinley was assassinated. At that time, Teddy Roosevelt became the youngest president in U.S. history, gaining the office just before his 43rd birthday. He was still 42 years old. Amazing things he did, as you can see from this first page, is that he saved 230 million acres of open space during his presidency, or 84,000 acres for every single day he was in office. And you can see the list of things that he accomplished. The 150 national forests that he set aside include the Chippewa and Superior National Forests in northern Minnesota that were set aside in 1908 and 1909. And the 51 federal bird reservations. The first one was Pelican Island in Florida, set aside in 1903. And he went down there to look at it, and at that time it was popular for women to have feathers in their hats. And those birds were being killed left and right to get their feathers to put on women's hats. So the very first bird sanctuary he established was Pelican Island in Florida in 1903. Then there were four national game preserves, five national parks, including Wind Cave National Park in South Dakota in 1903, 18 national monuments, including the Grand Canyon, which he set aside in 1908. And I have a quote from Teddy Roosevelt here. As he looked at that canyon and making it into a national monument, you may want to listen to what he had to say because it has some application for today. He says, "I hope there will not be a building of any kind, not a summer cottage, a hotel, or anything else to mar the wonderful grandeur, sublimity, the great loneliness, and beauty of this canyon." Which reminds me of the bridge they just built across the canyon. It's been in the news lately. Something Teddy Roosevelt would not support. And then there were 24 reclamation projects, 7 conservation conferences and commissions. So he did a great deal to preserve open space. And the situation here in Minnesota is something I'm quite concerned about because of the rate we're losing agricultural land. And I've got a book here that I put together, Life Size, Good for the Economy, Good for the Environment. And if you just take this, could everybody just take this book for a moment and open it to page 16? There's two page 16s, unfortunately, in this book.
Which one do we want?
The second page 16. It's the title of this page is Minnesota's 79,300 Farmers and Their Gross Annual Revenue. And that top chart starts with the year 1993. And if you look across there, you'll see there was 86,000 farms and 29,700,000 acres of land and farms in 1993. Now, if you go down to the bottom of the chart, 2006, you'll see we're at 79,300 farms, but only 27,400,000 acres of farmland. So you do the arithmetic there, and it comes out to a 2.3 million acre loss of farmland in about 14 years. Now, if we keep losing farmland at that rate, in 200 years, there won't be any farmland left. Now, we're worried about wetland losses, and we lost a lot of wetlands. We're appropriately concerned about it. But at the rate we're losing farmland, it's a very serious matter. And I think we need to do something more significant to do that. But now, in the interest of full disclosure, These numbers come from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. The USDA has some slightly different numbers, and so the loss may not be quite that high. They're showing a 2.2 million acre loss over a 25-year period, 1978 to 2002. But they summarize that the true number is probably somewhere between their number and Minnesota's number. So either way, it's a significant loss of farmland. Now, I'm going to go through this bill and later make reference to this book at a later moment here in just a few minutes. But if we take the bill itself, I'll show you what it does. On page one of the bill, line 1.13, there's a paragraph titled Comprehensive Plan. These units of government that do have planning and zoning have to have a comprehensive plan as described in state law. And the first underlined sentence says, when adopting or updating the comprehensive plan, the board must, if the data is available to the county, consider natural heritage data resulting from the county biological survey. The reason that's in there, and not every county has a completed biological survey, but that does identify some very critical areas within the county. It might be some fens or rare plants, animal populations that need some special consideration by the Planning and Zoning Authority. The second sentence reads, the board must consider adopting policies that will protect open space and the environment by adopting the state's livestock production policy. I'm going to come back to that sentence here when I get done with this bill to explain a little more what that means. Section 2 is a very important part of this bill, and a lot of the ideas in here came from Ron Harnack and were refined by others that attended these meetings. And I'm just going to go through it. The comprehensive plan adopted in a county outside the metropolitan area, as defined by Section 473.121, Subdivision 2, must contain priority provisions for the preservation of agricultural, forest, wildlife, and open space land, and minimizing development in sensitive shoreland areas that are identified as priority provisions of the comprehensive plan and that are consistent with Sections 48.05, Subdivision 2. At the time of the next updating of the comprehensive plan, it must contain the priority provisions, and within 3 years, the county must adopt ordinances as part of the county's official controls that ensure that the goals and objectives of the priority provisions are implemented. Now, starting in line 2.5, the goals and objectives shall include the following six items. Number one, minimizing the fragmentation and development of agricultural, forest, wildlife, and open space lands. Number two, minimizing further development in sensitive shoreland areas. Number three, minimizing development near wildlife management areas, scientific and natural areas, and nature centers. Number four, encouraging development within city limits. Number five, encouraging development close to places of employment, shopping centers, schools, mass transit, and other public and private service centers. Now, that particular provision has been described by some as a climate control provision, because we're releasing carbon dioxide no matter where we go, but if we would just live close to where do we work and so forth, we'd be kicking out a lot less CO2 as we move around. And number six, encouraging farms, privately owned forest lands, and other privately owned open spaces to stay in business and not sell for development. Now, some of this language is repeated, and starting line 2.2, that's some language is repeated. I'm going to drop down to subdivision 4 on page 2, line 2.26, and this is development priority. In adopting official controls after July 1st of 2007, the county must, to the greatest extent practical, do so with respect to new residential, commercial, and industrial development so that the new development takes place in areas under the following priority sequence. Number one, the highest priority must be given to new development in a statutory or home rule charter city in which city water and sewer services is currently available. I'm not going to read the whole thing. Go to number two on page three, top of page three. The next priority would be areas immediately adjacent to the city that is zoned for commercial, residential, commercial, or industrial development, and city and water sewer service is either currently available or is to be made available in the near future. Number three, on line 3.6, the next priority would be areas in which clustered development is permitted and city water and sewer services currently available. Now, the word city may not be quite right there. Maybe it should be, say, community, because you do have some of these rural developments that do have some community sewer and water available. The fourth priority is in areas in which cluster development is permitted, but city water and sewer services is not currently available. Number five, the next priority would be scattered development in which no more than one development or residential unit for each 160 acres would be permitted. And then the last priority is where the concentration of development is scattered but more concentrated than 160 acres would be permitted. Many counties have a 1 per 40 and so on, 1 per 80 in some townships and so forth. Okay, now I'll go to Section 5, down at the bottom of page 3. The new language reads, official controls adopted after July 1st, 2007, applicable to agricultural, forest, wildlife, and open space land must be consistent with Section 48.05, Subdivision 3. It must be adopted and applied to ensure to the greatest extent practical the preservation of agriculture, forest, wildlife, and open space land, and to minimize the development of sensitive shoreland areas. Now, if you go to page 4, we're going to be repeating some of the things we've already repeated, and I'm not going to repeat it because this is language that is repeated in another section of law that deals with townships and cities. So it's the same language I just covered, only it's repeated again in another section of law to cover, as I mentioned, townships and counties.
Mr. Chairman.
Now, that's the presentation of the bill. I just want to hold this booklet up here. This is a study done by the Department of Agriculture that shows that it's more expensive for local units of government to have scattered development than to have it more in a concentrated area. It costs more for road construction, maintenance, deliver the mail, pick up the kids. There's all kinds of police, fire costs, and so forth associated with scattered development. So from an economic standpoint, if you're a Republican interested in low-cost government, you should be interested in more planned development to decrease the cost of delivering government services. Now, I'm going to just finish this up, Mr. Chair. Was there a question?
Would you be willing to take a question from
yes.
Senator Olson?
Okay.
So, Mr. Chairman, maybe you said it and I missed it, but there's a constant reference to Section 48.05. What's that general topic of that?
Okay, copy of it right here, and it's titled Elements of the Plan and Official Controls. And it's making a reference to item number 5, identification of areas in which development is occurring or likely to occur during the next 20 years. And the reason that's in there is that in the Department of Ag, there's two planning and zoning experts, Bob Patton and Paul Burns, and they felt that this was important to tie the plan back to this other section of state law.
Thank you.
Senator Parasol.
Mr. Chairman, my question is on the section you just completed explaining to us, Senator Dill, is how do you envision the very likely possibility, because you have, you know, from the central city and then adjacent to the city and then out farther than that.
Mm-hmm.
How do you envision the obvious disputes or unresolved issues that would come up where people own land in more than one jurisdiction and probably in different counties? Because yours is aimed at sort of a county level basic start.
Senator Dill.
Mr. Chair, Senator Parasol, I'm going to point to the county I represent, McLeod County, who I think has done something rather significant and spectacular in 2006. And that was a revised planning and zoning ordinance to not allow any further residential industrial development beyond the 2-mile city limit boundary of a charter city or incorporated area. So they're not going to let this development occur just helter-skelter anywhere they want. If somebody wants it across the county, that has to be within 2 miles of existing city limits. The second thing they did is they are not allowing any further development along the lake shores of environmental lakes, and there's about 20 of them in the county. The setback is 1,000 feet from an environmental lake, so they're doing something I think pretty significant in that county. If they can do it, other counties can do it.
Mr. Chairman, I'm wondering whether, you know, if you have a parcel that might be on both sides of a county line, of county lines, so if you have a parcel that might be in more than one county, or even more, it could be in a corner with 3 or 4 counties.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Paris, it wouldn't be the same parcel. It might be the same ownership, but it would have to be two separate parcels because it's in two separate jurisdictions. You couldn't have one parcel that straddled the boundary, I don't think. It would either be in or out of one. It would be two parcels. Part would be in one parcel would be in one county, one would be in the other county.
My question is, Mr. Chairman, how do you work that out when you have a proposal for it or somebody who wishes to do fill in the blank?
Could it be? Don't we have other situations like with school districts
sort of
and with land straddling school district? Basically, one parcel is deemed to be part of one or the other.
Mm-hmm. As far as I know, the parcels are either in one district or out of it, one or the other. I mean, the parcels are. Well, the boundaries generally follow county lines or school district lines, and.
Well, I forget the name of the lake in straddling. I think it straddles Todd and Wadena County. We came up with regards to shoreland issues.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you've got, obviously you have development issues that are different on one side of the lake than you do on the other side. So I think that's what Senator mm-hmm. Paraso is referring to.
New Prague is an example. It's split right down the middle in two counties.
City of New Prague is in right. Two different counties?
Two different counties. Mm-hmm. Which side of the street you're on determines which county you're in.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, there are joint powers boards, and there's ways that these planning and zoning boards work this out.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm sure New Prague does something with regards to both counties. Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions, Senator. On page one, is it rather vague, or is it the open space and minimizing development? What kind of a number do we put on minimizing? Does one developer have a different number than the other, or is it? I understand the concept, but keeping it down.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Engelbretson, the DNR has developed some new shoreland recommendations with a study group that met extensively up in the Bemidji-Brainerd area. And these recommendations are not applied statewide at this point in time because they weren't developed in that way. They were developed as potential voluntary provisions that counties could adopt if they wanted to. And in those recommendations, there's varying levels of density that are allowed for different types of lakes. And in the case of my McLeod County, they just chose to take environmental lakes and just shut down the development almost completely on those areas. But the lot size depends on the type and quality of the lake. Setbacks are there that are different, and there's a lot of detail in there. And my county of Meeker has adopted part of that recommended new shoreland ordinance, but that would be one thing a county could do is look at adopting the part of that recommendation that they think would work for them.
Thank you. Stand now, page 3, line 311. Just a rookie question here, the next priority would be for scattered development in which no more than one development or residential unit for each 160 acres. Is there a difference between a development and one residential unit? And wouldn't one residential unit be one house, or am I all wrong on that? Are they the same?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Engelbretson, that's a question that did get discussed here a couple of weeks ago, and that we may need to do a little wordsmithing there to make that more clear, but I guess the thought is that you're generally thinking about a residential unit, but there could be some, you know, a business, I suppose, of some sort or some other machine shed being built or something. But a little wordsmithing might be appropriate on that sentence.
Thank you.
Senator Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Dill, what do you think about having this be a statewide proposal rather than excluding the metropolitan area?
Senator Dill?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, I think that might be something to consider here. I'm thinking back as to how we were thinking 2 years ago, and maybe we thought it was a little easier to apply it to areas that didn't have a lot of urban sprawl already. And you've got so much here that it's maybe more problematic to apply that to the metro area. But if it works, or if there's some elements here that could be applied to the metro area, I'm not opposed to that.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think it raises a lot of good principles that could apply Except for the livestock production policy. But the rest of it, I think, would be really helpful to add into our planning discussions.
Okay.
Well, Senator Anderson, we had a big controversy in Fridley regarding ownership of a potbelly pig. And the city deemed that to be livestock because it was a pig. And so, and since the person didn't have an 1 acre minimum size lot, that she was not allowed to keep it.
Well, Mr. Chair,
that seems unfair.
When I was door knocking this summer, I came across a neighbor who lives just not far from me who has chickens.
Uh-huh.
And apparently you can get permits to do that in St. Paul. I was rather surprised. And I'd get one except for my killer cat.
Yeah, you have a
cat place.
Maybe you need a permit for the killer cat.
It'd be great to have fresh eggs.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And education for all the kids in the neighborhood. My neighbors are already pretty tolerant of me.
And would cut down the need.
I could push that, but
it would cut down the need for alarm clocks.
Yeah,
Senator Olson.
Well, while we're telling stories, this just brought back a memory of one when I was door knocking this fall too. There was a. This woman, she, actually, they run a greenhouse out in Medina, and she was telling about their son wanting a little different project and wanted to raise chickens. And she said, did you see them? Because she was working on a landscaping project, and I said, no. Well, they, all of a sudden, she just said, chickens, chickens, and here comes running this whole trail of stream of these beautiful, glossy, black chickens. They just came right up and stopped. It was just like they were marching in formation, like the movie Babe. It was just so it's kind of fun to see.
And what did she
like
say
that.
To get them?
She said, chickens, chickens, and they kept getting
they're used to
running.
It. They're trained well.
Mr. Chair, they're probably used to being fed some oats or something then when she called them.
Yeah, and then they stopped and started picking in the grass, and it was just one of the more delightful.
Senator Dibble.
Well, as long as we're telling stories, Mr. Chair.
we need a little catharsis.
We had, I worked for a neighborhood organization before I came to the House that had where there were two pigs living in a pretty dense city neighborhood, but one of the pigs had actually foiled a robbery attempt and by biting the assailant. The guy actually assaulted the woman who owned him and bit him pretty seriously. And
we didn't read about that in the paper, though.
Oh, it was a big story actually, and there was actually a TV story about it, and it was really great. So they let that pig and its companion stay. They just decided to look the other way. It became kind of the crime-fighting mascot of the neighborhood. You know.
The house must have been quite a sty. Senator Ingerman.
Senator, I have to ask the question, that pig have the permit to carry then?
Okay, Senator Dill, on with your bill.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, at this point in time in the livestock discussion, I'd like to direct you to page 3 of this booklet that I presented to you. And this is a page 3 is a description of the state of Minnesota's livestock production policy. Policy of the state is to promote livestock production, family farms, under a broad range of systems, sound and meet all legal requirements of all jurisdictions, including federal, state, county, town, city, and watershed district requirements. In order to promote livestock production on family farms, state agencies shall, when appropriate, to the extent allowed by law, establishment of livestock enterprises on family farms, promote environmental protection and water quality improvement through increased livestock production that results in controlling runoff through increased acreages of hay, pasture, and small grains, and more farms to use agronomically applied manure to increase the water holding capacity of the soil and control erosion. I suppose many people on this committee might be surprised to know that there is a policy that says we're going to protect the environment by increasing livestock production. But if you note on page 4, that's a resolution we passed a year or so ago that was authored by some people seated at this table and some that are no longer with us, asking the residents of Minnesota for tolerance of different views on animal agriculture production practices, making 2005 the year the Minnesota feedlot wars ended and marks the beginning of a new era for Minnesota livestock farmers characterized by peace, love, harmony, and acceptance of diversity. Now it's time to laugh at that. Now, just to continue this, I want to redirect not going to go through this whole book at this point in time, but I want you to turn to page 19. This is a list of reasons why livestock is good for the environment. I'll go through this as quickly as I can. Number one, cattle, sheep, and horse production requires hay pasture and small grain production. This rotation controls erosion and runoff much better than the typical corn-soybean rotation and has significant groundwater quality benefits. By the way, this book has been reviewed by about 100 times, and a number of experts have weighed in, so I think my information should be reasonably accurate and verifiable. There's a two-page bibliography to support all this stuff. Item number two, fields fertilized with manure that are improperly managed have increased water-holding capacity. Peer-reviewed research from across the U.S. shows runoff is reduced 2 to 62%, and soil loss is reduced 15 to 65% as compared to control sites that were not fertilized with manure. Number three, University of Minnesota research in Moore shows decreased phosphorus runoff at sites fertilized with manure that is properly managed. Now, you might think you put manure in the field, you get more phosphorus runoff. That's not what happens. Increased water holding capacity and so on, and you actually have less runoff. Number four, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency study completed in 2004 found that only 1% of the phosphorus entering our surface waters is coming from feedlots. In contrast, non-agricultural rural runoff contributes 5.7% of the total phosphorus, and septic systems another 3.7%. Now, on that particular point, I want you to turn the page to page 20. Can everybody turn over to page 20? Because this is a bar engineering study, and it shows the estimated total phosphorus contribution to Minnesota surface waters. And number one is cropland and pasture runoff at 26.4%, atmospheric deposition at 13%, commercial and industrial water use at 12%, stream bank erosion 11%, municipal sewage treatment plants 10.9%, and so on down the list. And feedlots are at 1%, which everybody's so bent out of shape over feedlots, but it's really kind of a minor source of phosphorus entering our surface waters. Let's go back to page 19. Number five, nitrogen leaching losses on fields fertilized with manure applied at agronomic rates are comparable and sometimes less than fields using commercial fertilizer. Manure has the advantage of slowly releasing nitrogen over a two-year period. And point number six, acreages of perennial forages such as alfalfa and clover are increased with dairy and beef operations. These crops are excellent at reducing nitrate leaching losses, which are 30 to 50 times less than a corn-soybean rotation. Now, I just want to comment on this a little bit. Alfalfa's got a very deep root system, uses a lot of nitrogen, sucks up all the nitrogen in the soil profile, plus it takes nitrogen out of the air. Whereas with a corn-soybean rotation, the plants only live a few months, die. You've got a lot of leaching that can occur. In a normal rainfall year, there's about 30 times as much nitrogen leaching from a corn-soybean rotation than an alfalfa field. And in a high rainfall year, it may get up to 50 times as much. And this is what's going down the Mississippi River, causing the dead zone at the end of the Mississippi River. It's nitrogen, not phosphorus, in the case of that saltwater environment. And then on point number seven, the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources research in southeastern Minnesota over a 30-year period shows that streams and pastures that were rotationally grazed had better water quality than the same streams in areas that were not grazed. This is partially due to trees growing up in the non-grazed area, causing the grass to die, resulting in more stream bank erosion. Where the cattle grazed, the trees did not grow, but the grass grew right up to the edge of the stream, providing excellent erosion control. Today, trout are more numerous in the grazed portion of the stream. And then the final comment is what we're dealing with today, urban sprawl, plus other things. Farmers that produce livestock are more likely to make a living on the farm and will continue to farm in the future. Successful farms ensure that open space and agricultural land is preserved, wildlife habitat protected. Selling off lots for non-farm development is less likely to occur. This helps address one of the major concerns of many environmental organizations, and that is controlling urban sprawl. So what I want you to do now is just turn page 25. This shows a farm where the research was done on grazing streams. And you'll see in that middle picture on page 25, the farmer standing there. The grass is right down to the edge of the stream, protecting the stream from erosion right down to the water's edge. Where I'm standing at the bottom is where the stream was fenced off. You've got stream bank erosion. trees have grown, growing up, and the grass has died, and much more significant water quality problems. And I'm going to finish my comments on with line page 27. Key here is a properly sited and engineered livestock farm that managed follows the new 7020 Minnesota State feedlot rules and implements best management practices is good for the environment because less soil erosion, less water runoff, less phosphorus runoff, less nitrogen leaching, better soil fertility, better water quality, less urban sprawl, fewer vehicles on the road commuting to distant jobs, more diversity in the cropping system, more pasture land, fewer row crops on marginal land, more open space preserved, more agricultural land preserved, more wildlife habitat is protected, better control of plant disease, weed, and insect cycles, and better. When I look at it, we don't have enough money to buy all the development rights from all the land we want to keep from being developed. We've got to do it a cheaper and better way, and planning and zoning is the way to do it. So that's what this bill focuses on.
Thank you, Senator Dale. Question, Senator Vickerman.
And Mr. Chair, I want to pick up on what Senator Anderson asked, because I had two people in my office this morning also looking if we could expand this more. Senator Dale and one of them gentlemen happened to work for the Met Council, and he said they don't really do anything in this direction. So it's way above me. I'd have to rely on somebody who's in the Metro, but I think we ought to at least take a look at it and see if it would fit in certain places.
Okay, good.
Senator Olson?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Vickerman, at one point there was an agricultural advisory group working with the Met Council, because we still do have a fair amount of ag land.
In the same kind.
You know, part of our problem is with the way Met Council manages and has put, you know, some strict limits on that, the growth is actually leapfrogging outside of the seven-county metro area into the counties beyond. And I think that that's almost having a greater impact on removing agricultural land and farmland from the from that industry or enterprise than it is within the seven-county metro area.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's cited as one of the factors for leapfrog, but in those places where you know some of those mucilage confinements have been loosened, there still is. I mean, I don't know that we can just attribute the land use controls that the Met Council imposes for some of that leapfrog speculation and some of that development that occurs beyond the metro area and the mucilage.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Olson?
I think it affects because of what happens to land values with that, and so people are looking for cheaper land in order to have more affordable housing, and so they leap outside of that metro area. I mean, I'm not sure how you manage that, and
for somebody to not
studies
and
trying
to
you know, it obviously it is tied to you know, the availability of urban services, but it's still the fact that when you do have those, you drive the land values up, and if people are looking for ways around it, they'll find it.
Senator Dibble, follow up? Or?
Well, Mr. Chair, we had this debate a couple of years ago, and I think the studies show that wasn't the sole contributing factor. And if you look to the comparisons in other metropolitan areas, you still see the same, that don't have the kind of land use controls in the urban services boundary. You still have the leapfrog development and the speculation that goes on even beyond the metro area.
So. Senator Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm going to try this amendment.
We do have three other people that want to testify, but
okay. Well,
feel free to amend.
I'll see what Senator Dill thinks. I would just delete the language that says in Greater Minnesota on one line 21 in the headnote, and then 1.22, delete adopted in a county outside the metropolitan area as defined by section 473.121 subdivision 2, comma. And then I think delete that same language on page 4, line 18 to 19. There's probably some other changes that would need to be made. I'm not sure, but off the top of my head, I would propose that change, just to not limit it to outside the metropolitan area.
Senator Neal.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson talked to me about this just before the meeting started, or just before I got up here, and that would be fine with me to at least do that for the time being and see what the reaction is.
Mr. Knopf, did you follow that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The only other thing in the head note, I think these are dealing with other head notes that also say comprehensive plans or plan. You may want to just say comprehensive plans, semicolon, open space. So this is kind of more, this is more kind of an open space direction, just to make sure the head note, we don't, kind of clarifies what we're talking about.
That's fine. I incorporate that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Frederickson.
Senator Anderson, would you say your amendment again?
In section 2, page 1, line 21, delete in the head note, delete in Greater Minnesota and insert colon open space on line 1.22, delete adopted in a county outside the metropolitan area as defined by section 473.121 subdivision 2 comma, delete what I all of that, and then on page 4, delete the same thing, delete in Greater Minnesota, page 4 line 18, delete in Greater Minnesota, and then delete on line 19, outside the metropolitan area as defined in section 473.121 subdivision 2 comma.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, you also wanted off to, on 4.19, delete adopted in a municipality outside. So basically it would read a comprehensive plan must contain provisions at when you're finished.
Oh, well, I thought maybe adopted in a municipality needed to stay in there. I'm not
well,
sure.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, this is only municipal planning in this. I mean, that 462 is municipal planning.
Senator Olson, to the point.
Mr. Chairman, just having been through this challenge with the city I live in dealing with Metropolitan Council, a city might want to do that, but the Metropolitan Council, if they in fact have already built capacity for extension of municipal services, they won't accept the comprehensive plan if it doesn't, provide for, a logical progression of that extension for development. And the challenge within that is getting people to recognize how you might, you talked about the clustering. Sometimes we still don't. Some people think equate density with the whole clustering idea, and they think if you divide everything up in an acre lot instead of the three or four lots to an acre, they don't like that density. But if you divide everything up instead in acre lots, you've ruined all potential of retaining any kind of a natural landscape because you chop it up in all these bits that spoil it all. Instead of if you clustered on smaller lots and left some open space, you can preserve some of that character. That in some areas, it still may not be practical to preserve agriculture unless you have a benefactor like we had in Minnetrista who donated his 410-acre farm for the Gale Woods Farm to be a sustainable farm and park for people to come and learn about such things, the compatibility of agriculture and the environment, and allow that to continue in that fashion. But I appreciate Senator Anderson's attempt here, but I think there may have to be a slight modification of that for the metro area, given what the realities are here.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering, would this go next to state and local government, or do we know which committee it's going to next?
Mr. Chair, it should go to state and local government.
So I think, they could figure out some of those nuances, that if there needs to be some different structures set up for the metropolitan area. But I think the basic concepts are good in terms of protecting open space and agricultural land, and I really support that. So I'd like to move the amendment in that spirit and then know that this is going to be further tweaked as it moves forward.
Senator Pariseau.
Mr. Chairman, it seems to me, members, that I think the reason that Senator Dill drafted it as he did is because he knew that the seven counties are being comprehensively planned at the Metropolitan Council level right now, because everybody, including all the townships, are subject to it. So I don't know that this changes much for the metro area, but I don't know that they have to be identical to outstate either. They certainly aren't comparable for uses, typically.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that may well be true. I agree with Senator Pariseau that I suspect strongly that By policy, there is some call for preserving our open spaces in the metropolitan area. As a matter of practicality, though, that's not happening, at least to the extent that it maybe should. And, you know, we see that every year and, you know, every other year in Senator Linkseth's bonding bill, you know, call for more resources than we have to preserve open space in the metro area. And you saw the success of the Dakota County as well as the Washington County referendum, in which people agreed to tax themselves to set aside more open space than is being. So I think it's good that we maybe adopt a strong statement in statute that sends, that kind of emphasizes and underscores our desire to do that in the metropolitan area.
Well, Senator Dill, you're going to be a popular guy after this amendment.
Well, Mr. Chairman, as I mentioned earlier, I think we should adopt the Anderson Amendment for the time being and just see how it unfolds in the next committee and so forth.
I won't oppose you.
Okay. That's more discussion, obviously.
Want to understand the amendment? On the motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Senator Dill, do you have any other comments before we move on to witnesses?
Not at this time.
Do you have any witnesses?
Well, I have some people that I talked to, and I think there's three on the list. I don't know. Gary Botzik from Minnesota Waters wants to say something, and there may be some others as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gary Botzik, actually from Minnesota Conservation Federation. Minnesota Waters let me go because I didn't do enough comprehensive planning, I think. But I just wanted to weigh in, and I've been part of Senator Dill's discussions over the last couple of years, and I have a lot of respect for his insight and perspective on what he's trying to do here. And being a farm kid, I appreciate that even more. My dad just passed away a year ago, and we're trying to decide what to do with his little 120-acre farm in Benton County, and I was just informed by my brother the other night that the county changed their zoning now from 40-acre parcels down to 10. So now we have the option of trying to sell a 120-acre nice farm, 80 acres tillable. Elk River runs through it. They haven't done a movie on that yet, but a nice hobby farm for someone, but it's more valuable to chip it up in 10 acres times 12 people living on that township road as compared to one farmer. So that's another insight. It's not a pork belly or a pot belly story, but it's, you know, that's what's happening in rural Minnesota and to some degree in some of the Dakota County and Northwest Hennepin and your county. So he's right, and this needs to be looked at, but it's very multifaceted, just like every issue you folks deal with. It's not simple. I just was at a meeting yesterday with a bunch of groups that are working on the federal farm bill, and I don't know if you've gotten a copy of this, but this is called Growing Conservation in the Farm Bill, headed up by, of course, Teddy Roosevelt Conservation Partnership. Jim Platt works for this group, and we were meeting, and here's Teddy Roosevelt, of course. He quoted Aldo Leopold, who said, "We abuse land because we regard it as a commodity, belonging to us." And these federal farm bills have historically tried to deal with that as a commodity. And now the last farm bills, particularly the very last one, has spent a lot more time, a lot more emphasis, a lot more money on the conservation aspect of trying to preserve agricultural land as well as open spaces. And we expect a lot more out of that in the next farm bill, and you've been reading and hearing about that and participating in your resolutions and meetings with Colin Peterson and others. Teddy Roosevelt also said conservation means development as much as it means protection. He said, "I recognize the right and duty of this generation to develop and use natural resources of our land, but do not recognize the right to waste them or to rob by wasteful use the generations that come after us." And he said, it's back to the farmer. He said, "The farmer is a good farmer who, having enabled the land to support himself and provide for the education of his children, leaves it to them a little better than he found it himself. I believe this is the same thing for our nation." And this is his quote in August 31st of 1910, down in Kansas. But land use planning in Minnesota is kind of like beauty. It's in the eyes of the beholder. We used to have a full state planning agency in Minnesota that, and some of you longer in tooth remember when state planning agency had some responsibilities and some direction and some leadership in these kind of issues. That's gone. The state agencies continue to plan comprehensively and otherwise. DNR, Metro Council, you talked about them today a lot. Met Council, Department of Ag, DNR, everybody plans. The question is, and so is local governments, and you're going to hear from them, cities, counties, townships, everybody's got plans, comprehensive or otherwise. The question is, who's coordinating them? Where's the overlay? Where's the transparency of trying to lay these upon each other to do the best as far as protection of ag land, preserving some for conservation, as well as parks, trails, all the rest of the urbanizing needs that our society is asking for? And that's why groups like the Conservation Federation, and we work on specialized land use needs too. We're big on WMAs, as you know, and Audubon will come in here, and I represent them too, scientific and natural areas. What about aquatic management areas, parks and trails? We were working on buffering of shooting ranges, just like we're talking about buffering WMAs now from urban sprawl. These are issues that are occurring in the Metro 7 as well as the Outstate 80. Green acres. A lot of you folks participated in setting up green acres over the years, and that was a design to protect ag land, as you recall, in the seven counties, and did a good job. But it also kind of banked the appreciation in some of that land, which a lot of it's been developed, shall we say. And that's, we're not going to stop development. All we're trying to do is manage development and I think let more people participate in the process. So to that point, we don't necessarily support the entire bill, but we certainly believe it's a step in the right direction and deserves the opportunity to continue, and let's continue to discuss it and keep working on it. So I'll stop there, Mr. Chairman. Take any questions.
Thank you, Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As the committee might probably recognize, I probably want to say something about the forest lands that are in here and that you mentioned, Senator Dill. When you started this whole process, I don't think we knew that our forests, our private forests, were going to be fragmented in the way that they appear to be going right now. And of course, we do have forest legacy that come forward as a answer to this. But we do have the opportunity with our forests right now to learn from what has happened to a lot of our farmland, and that it was fragmented and the access isn't always there. And after all, private forests, for the most part, if managed properly, have a lot of the same characteristics as farmland. So, however this relates, I think I would support it from that particular standpoint. The reduction of the fragmentation of our open spaces, forests, agriculture land, and the like.
Yeah. Well, Senator Saxall, you're right. The forest fragmentation issue wasn't on our radar 2 years ago, but it got plugged in this year. As I mentioned earlier, members of the committee, we got through six drafts of this bill by March 30th of 2005. Then we set it aside, and the draft before you is a seventh draft. And that's where we picked up the forest fragmentation language.
Thank you. Okay. Any other witnesses that you have in support of your bill, Senator? Bill? I don't know. Whoever wants to
start. I don't know who's back there, whether they want to support it or pick at it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sulem with the Minnesota Association of Townships. And I'll start by saying that we too support the intent of what Senator Dill is trying to do, and we appreciate the fact that he has tried to work with us over the past few years to try to see if we can come up with some kind of legislation that works. Unfortunately, this is not it yet, and so we are unable to support this bill. We'd be happy to work with the senator or any work group that would like to be started over the summer, and perhaps next session, the eighth or ninth draft, we might finally have it. But this version, there is no way we can support as townships and as local government. And let me just go through some of the reasons why. As I say, you know, the intent is very admirable, and townships actually have a very vested interest in making sure that there is rural area preserved, open space, ag land. That is something that our members are very keenly supportive of, because it does help prevent against some annexation efforts that come about. However, zoning is about balance. Zoning is about trying to weigh competing interests and finding that right balance that works for the local community. And as we've been trying to promote with our members, looking at a more regional approach, working with the neighbors and saying, hey, what is good for this region, not just our little tract of land, this city or that city, this township, that township. What is good for a region? We were very opposed to the elimination of the State Department of Planning. This did provide neutral information. We'd love to see that restored to help provide a neutral guidance and overview. But some of the provisions in this bill are actually counterproductive to the goals, and it is preemptive of local control. I'll start with some of the on the county sections, and townships are concerned about county zoning because that's the basis of ours. Anything the county does becomes the default for the township, and we can get more restrictive, but we have to start at the county level. And much of the language is duplicative for the city and township provisions, so the comments on the county sections apply as well to the city and towns. Starting in 1.19, you know, I don't know that there's a problem saying that we have to consider data that's available. There's information out there. We want our folks making informed choices. But when it's you add language in the statute that says you must consider adopting policies, by adopting the state's policy, well, that's no longer consideration. That's setting an absolute mandate that this is it, this is the policy. And Senator Anderson, I believe you've already alluded to the fact that there are many groups that are not real fond of the state's ag policy for differing reasons. Some don't like it for environmental concerns. Some don't like it because they think it's anti-small farm. That's not my issue. My issue is that it is would create a mandate on us saying you must consider a policy by adopting this policy. And that's not consideration. That's mandate. Going on to the language that's on what starts the first time in 1.23 contains priority provisions. We've had this discussion over the few years we've worked on this bill. From a legal perspective, I can't tell you what a priority provision means. I don't know what that does to other land users. I don't know what that does for the lawsuits that are going to follow. I do know it sets a bad precedent, so you can guarantee there will be a long line of people in front of your offices saying, we want to be a priority use next year. Again, zoning is about striking balance, weighing everybody's competing interests and trying to find the right balance, not trying to create priorities and favoritism for one group over another. Turning to on page 2, the first time it appears on 2.11, encouraging development within city limits. As currently drafted, and we've raised this argument over the years, that's actually counterproductive to your anti-sprawl. And the reason for that, and I know Mr. Johnson may disagree, we laugh about this section over time. What that simply says is, if I'm a landowner and I want to build, I petition to be annexed, because then I'm in the city limits. It doesn't matter how far away I am from the existing city limits, as long as I get my geographic boundary changed to say I'm now in city limits, I'm now allowed to do all this development as a priority. And so an example of that happened outside the city of Winona last year. We had a township that had a farm that was purchased by a St. Paul landowner or person who bought the land down outside of Winona. Township said, no, this should not be developed. It's got a sensitive trout stream in it. It's surrounded by 7 feedlots. This is a rural area. We want to preserve this as a rural area. The county said, you're right, we don't want to develop this land. The fellow from St. Paul wanted to build, so he annexed the property. And the argument was, well, in order to develop it, it has to have city services. So now we're going to drive a sewer line under a protected trout stream to develop land 2.5 miles outside the city limits, cutting off all future expansion of the 7 existing feedlots. This language in this bill would actually create that as an unintended consequence, that that's now promoted priority, because that's what they'd have to do, get inside those city limits. Again, on 2.23, we have the adopting the state livestock policy as a mandate, not just a consideration. 2.30 uses the term new development, but we don't define what development is. There are actually developments that make sense in rural areas. Ask anybody that in downtown St. Paul if they want another ethanol plant on Main Street. You're probably not going to get too many takers. Implement dealers, things that are related to the ag uses, belong out in the rural areas. The shooting ranges that we worked so hard on a couple of years ago, not something you normally want to find inside the inner city limits. And so we need to work on defining what is meant by the type of development, the types of density issues that are involved. I think that Senator Dill made a good comment talking about city water and sewer, making that more of a community services, because there are alternative treatments that are actually better than traditional big pipe sewer. So that's something we definitely support. I know I want to wrap up and give my colleagues a chance here, but I was just trying to highlight some of the biggest issues. Another one, I've got it circled on line 4.25 towards the bottom of page 4. I know it's used elsewhere where it says that the ordinances adopted to implement the comp plans must ensure. Well, that's a laudable goal. Obviously, the whole intent of adopting zoning ordinances is to implement your comp plan. That's what 462.357 says. Anytime after the adoption of a land use plan, you may adopt ordinances to implement that plan. However, having language that says that we must guarantee, we must ensure that we're going to achieve that goal gives rise to potential lawsuits because things change over time. Best intents aren't always met. And having language saying it must absolutely ensure raises legal issues versus having best practices. I guess I'll wrap up by saying that, again, we support what the senator wishes to do. We'd be happy to have a summer work group continue working on this. But in its current form, it's too preemptive on local control. It has serious negative impacts on townships. It's counterproductive to its intent, and it's wrought with potential legal lawsuits against local units of government. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Johnson. I'm representing the League of Minnesota Cities. And
Ms. Garlitz, if you wanted to, we're intending on going next, feel free.
Mr. Chair, we'll be fine with this order, I think. The that I have can be fairly brief. I am very grateful to the work Senator Dill has done on this over the years. And as Mr. Sulem correctly predicted, we have less concerns with it than some of the township concerns because, frankly, it prioritizes land use in a similar way to what most of our communities try to do, which is develop in areas where we already have city services available first and then move away from those areas only as we are sure that we can start extending services in those directions. It does add some tools for us to use for protecting shoreline, protecting open spaces, gives clear guidance on that. I think my background, when I switched to working for the League of Minnesota Cities 4 years ago, I thought I had had my last time sitting here talking feedlots with Senator Dill. But I do question how useful it will be to tie the state's agricultural livestock production to city ordinances in many of our communities where we have literally no agricultural land or practices going on. It could cause some conflicts in some ways. I have to confess that since I've been there. I have not had cause to go over the state's livestock production practices yet, so I will look at that policy and provide comments as soon as I'm able to on that, Mr. Chair. I think really the only two concerns that I would point out right now are that this prioritization system sounds very good, but the devil will be in the details, is how do you prioritize future development in your community will happen in these following ways. Right now uses land use planning and zoning to prioritize what types of development happen in a place, but not necessarily where the development happens first. If someone comes up with a type of development that meets light industrial use, we have areas that we try and set up to be ready for light industrial development that may or may not also be places that have priority on this list. So it would take some work. Fortunately, the way the bill is set up, we have cities doing their comp plans between now and 2008, and we have 3 years after that to work on the ordinances. So the timing of this is pretty good to give us time to work on that right now. I see that as an implementation concern that we would have to address. The addition of the metropolitan area to this does add a twist to it that I've just been trying to think through since the amendment came on, Mr. Chair. And senators that were raising concerns about the Met Council are absolutely right, that the Met Council determines what kinds of land use are going to be okay for cities to have in their comprehensive plans. We must follow their land use planning requirements. And so it could set up instances where what the city is being required to do in this instance is not consistent with what the Met Council is telling them they have to do for density of development or where sewer and water will be extended next. Those are not issues that are in the control of all of our municipalities. So I think we will have to do some work with how this would function in the metropolitan area, Mr. Chair. With that, Senator Dill, again, for trying to address an issue that I think our cities really struggle with, which is how do we do responsible plan development in areas where there is high growth demand.
Senator Dill.
Mr. Chair, member, just one quick response here. We did hear from the townships that on line 1.19, when we say the board must consider adopting policies, my intention is not to, just you have to consider it. I don't see that that's necessarily a mandate. You have to adopt the policy. You just have to consider it. And in the case of the cities on this livestock issue, I believe the city's planning and zoning authority does reach out beyond the city limits 2 miles, if I'm not incorrect. And so there's plenty of room for feedlots and livestock production farms within a 2 mile radius or 2 miles of the edge of a city. So I just want cities to take this into account so they don't have to get too bent out of shape if a farm is producing livestock nearby. It's not, if it's properly managed, it's not bad for the environment. It may be good for the environment in many ways.
Mr. Chair, if I may just respond. What I was referring to, if it just simply said we must consider things, that's fine. I have no problem with having objectives and goals and raising the awareness. But on line 1.20, it goes on to state that the consideration is accomplished by adopting the state's livestock policy. It doesn't just stop at considering. It says the way we consider it is by adopting. And so it is mandating that our policy will be the state's policy. Considering the state policy is one thing, but saying the consideration is accomplished by adopting changes that scope. And that's where, the intent of the bill, we appreciate. The implementation of the bill is problematic. As to the 2 mile radius, what the law provides is that a city may, it's an optional provision, extend their zoning authority 2 miles outside the city limits unless the county or township is already exercising zoning authority. So it's only when there's absolutely no zoning authority that a city may extend 2 miles out.
All right. Ms. Garlitz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I, too, would like to echo.
Wouldn't mind introducing yourself.
Oh, sorry. My name is Annalie Garlitz with the Association of Minnesota Counties. I, too, would like to echo the appreciation that we have for Senator Dill for working on this and bringing to light all of the work that local units of government are doing when they're doing their comprehensive planning and zoning. Also mirroring what Mr. Solem said, we have many of the same concerns that he outlined when he kind of walked through the bill, and I won't do the same. Just wanted to go over that the counties do work with residents when they're developing their comprehensive plans, and I know that all counties strive to protect open space and agricultural lands, and in fact, some counties are made up of more than 50% of their land area is made up of open space, and many counties are striving to get more parkland and trails, and that is something that we work on, and that's something that citizens have indicated that they want. However, this is done by determining what the local residents value and what the character of the area is. And as you can imagine, with 87 counties, this varies from place to place. As noted, the priorities in this bill would outline what the priorities and the character of all throughout the state should be. And that really does vary with every locale. And it's hard to indicate to everybody across the state where their balance lies in their planning and zoning efforts. That's something that should be done on a local basis. Let's see. Some of the other, we're concerned about some of the other unintended consequences that counties could see in reference to development going on in those communities. We find that some of the restrictions and some of the priorities are a little bit too restrictive for some of these areas. I've spoken with several county planning and zoning administrators about this particular language, and the greatest concern is that this bill would eliminate the ability for counties and local communities to determine what should occur in their local area. Senator Dill mentioned McLeod County and the steps that they took to be more restrictive, and I thought that this was key because that was a decision that was made in McLeod County. The residents wanted that. That was something that did go forward, and there is demand in counties, and counties are being more restrictive in terms of their shoreland policies and in terms of how much development can happen in rural areas, how many acres you need per homestead. So I do think that this is important to continue talking about, and I welcome the opportunity, and I know that the planning and zoning administrators, the members of that association, also welcome the opportunity to continue work on this, but right now we have great concerns about the language. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, it's kind of interesting to note that McLeod County made their changes partly based on my sixth draft of this bill. They asked for a copy after the March 30th, 2005 date when we put it together, and they wanted to get out ahead of the curve. And so without even passing the bill, by just reading the sixth draft, they decided to limit development within 2 miles of city limits and restrict development within 1,000 feet of an environmental lake without even passing the law. So I think you can see the effect that this could have statewide if we could nudge these counties toward that direction.
Senator Dill, on page 16B, I guess. Number of farms lost. This is 1993 was 29 million acres, 30 million acres. Is that how many we're losing? That's how much land we have in
Mr. Chairman, members, this is from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, their statistics, and it shows 2.3 million acres lost during a 13 or 14 year period. And what's kind of interesting is if you look at the average size of the farms, even though they lost 2.3 million acres of farmland, the farm size is, it was 345 an acre in 93, and it's only 346 an acre in 2006. It's stayed the same in spite of all that loss. And that's very startling because if it continues at that rate, in 200 years we won't have any farmland left in this state. Now, I try to clarify this by the USDA figures don't quite jive with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture statistics. And USDA doesn't show as much loss during this period of time, but it's still very substantial.
Senator Anderson.
Oh, well, Mr. Chair, I just want to clarify something based on the testimony. When I mentioned the state livestock production policy, number one, I just was saying that I don't believe that would be an appropriate piece to have in the metropolitan area for the most part. I don't think that discussion would fit. Mm-hmm. But also, the way I read it is exactly the way Senator Dill explained, that it's that they have to consider it. It's not a mandate of any kind. So I don't see that as problematic.
All right, so we have a little bit of legislative intent there.
I think the question for us today is mm-hmm. is this good environmental policy?
Scott and Carver, Cota, Anoka, Washington, Ramsey, and Hennepin. Not in that order.
I think that's what we need to decide today. Senator Dill has been working on this legislation for several years. Certainly one of the people most aware of agriculture and agricultural policies in Minnesota and elsewhere. And he's done quite a bit of research Some agree, some do not agree, but he's done quite a bit of research on how the agriculture impacts the environment. And so he's come up with a proposal. I think urban sprawl is probably, I mean, if you just look back and dial the clock back a little in the metropolitan area, and what did we have for the most part before we had this big metropolitan area? And there were farms. For the most part, there were farms. And we've done a lot to, and if they weren't farms, they were probably wetlands or forests. And we've done a lot to protect our wetlands and some of our forests. We have the Wetland Conservation Act. But I don't think we have anything in along the lines of a Farmland Conservation Act, FACA. And so Senator Dill is trying to address that. I think it's good environmental policy, what you've got here. There might be things that we need to work on, clearly, but I think it's something that I think that something that has enough legs that we can start moving forward with a further discussion. Senator Sharon, did you have something?
Yes, I did. I was wondered if Senator Dill would respond to the discussion about the language in on line 1.20, which talks about the obligation rather than the consideration of the state's livestock production policy.
Chairman, Senator Sharan, I was looking at that sentence, and maybe to make people feel a little better about it, on line 1.20 after by, if we also inserted the words consider, by considering, then you've got the word consider in there twice in the same sentence, and maybe that would clarify more clearly that this is something to consider but not mandate. So it would read, the board must consider adopting policies that will protect open space and the environment by considering adopting the state's livestock production policy. And if that, I think I'd like to move that, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dill moves on page 1, line 20, after by, insert considering.
And Mr. Chairman, I also need to, there may be some other spots that maybe Mr. Knopf can spot real quickly, but there's also another, at least on page 4, line 4.15, after by, also insert the word considering.
All right, Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chairman, also on 2.23.
Page 1, line 20, page 2, line 23, page 4, line 15. Senator Fredrickson?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, I've also heard the suggestion that after policy, livestock reduction policy, that you reference that section of law, be under section 17.844, and do the same on page 2, line 23, page 4, line 15.
Senator Dill will incorporate that?
Yes, I will.
Further discussion on the amendment. Does everyone understand what we're doing? On the motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Further discussion?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Tom Peterson of Farmers Union would like to make a statement.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, I'll be very brief. My name's Tom Peterson. I represent the Farmers Union, and I've been sitting here listening to the discussion today, and I represent a lot of township officers and farmers, so they'd have a lot of the same concerns with the bill. And like the other groups, we strongly support the idea of supporting open space and ag land and seeing. I grew up on a farm in Chanhassen that's no longer there. It's about 90 homes now myself. But I want you to know, too, a lot of the things that were going on as you consider this bill. And so maybe as it moves forward, it becomes what if it's a study or we keep working on it, but it is important. The way state works on it now and the tools the state gives it is Green Acres is one idea, and Senator Scoy is really working on that this year. And he in your Senate tax bill, you're going to have some language that'll work on Green Acres. The state also has an ag land preserve law that we've had for 20 years that hardly anybody knows about that works well in the metro area, but we think it could be improved a lot. And so I would like to work with Senator Dill as this bill goes forward. And also you have Dakota County, Washington County that have passed referendums to protect open space in the last couple of years, and that's very important. And in Senator Dill's book on page 28, he has Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. And they have a deal in Pennsylvania where they bonded for money and put money into a trust to help preserve lots of open land. And that is maybe something that we need to consider next year as more of a bonding year when you're looking at preserving open land. Because also this is the year of rewriting the 2007 Farm Bill. And one of the programs that Dakota County has used is something called the Farmland, I think it's Protection Act, but it's not funded very well. But this next Farm Bill will probably put more money into that in September. And so if you come back and consider, perhaps this bill may work better to next year in also adding to that. So I just wanted to raise some of those issues because I think this is a good idea, but it still needs some work and in progress. So thank you.
Further discussion on Senate File 1402. Senator Dill, would you like to make a motion?
Mr. Chairman, members, I'll move that Senate File 1402 be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Local Government, Senator Rest Committee, I believe is whatever she's, I don't recall the exact title of that committee.
Senator Dill moves that Senate File 1402 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government. Is there anyone else who needed to testify in opposition to the bill? We pretty much covered the issues. Okay. This will be the end of our agenda. Before we move on this, I just wanted to mention a couple things on process over the next couple weeks. We have this week and next before we go on spring break. And then when we come back on spring break, that's the week that we have to – that is our policy deadline. Now, that seems like it's a lot of time. However – next week is absolutely riddled with session time to pass our omnibus finance bills. So that is leaving a scheduling problem for this committee. We're trying to deal with that. We've got a Monday morning meeting scheduled. But I just want members to know we don't have as much time as one might think. So if you've got bills that you really, really need to be heard, mention it to us because we're in the process where we have to triage some things. Even though you might have a hearing request in, you may have submitted it as a matter of course. Come and talk to us if this is something that really needs to be heard. And if there's something you want to mention that does not need to be heard, that would be welcome as well. So that's the only thing I needed to mention on that. On the Dill motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Meeting's adjourned.